From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In her new memoir, Judith Freeman says growing up as she did in Ogden in the 50s and 60s, everyone she knew at first was Mormon. Friends, family, all the politicians she knew of, and school teachers and business people. The non-Mormons she would encounter later, she saw not just as outsiders, but lost souls, some kind of heathens. In time, she says in her book, the heathens began to interest her. It took a long time for Judith Freeman to be ready to write a memoir, to retrace the path backward in her life, from respected novelist and humanist back to teenage bride in a Mormon neighborhood. Freeman will join us today to talk about her background and her realization that it would retain an inescapable prominence in her life, whether she wished it or not. Join us after the news.
Still thinking about that conversation on StoryCorps? Or the story you caught last weekend on Snap Judgment? The voices you hear on public radio stay with you. You can have a lasting effect on public radio, too. KUER sustainers give ongoing monthly contributions, providing a steady stream of income so we can continue to bring you the programs you can't get out of your head. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's this odd moment in Judith Freeman's new memoir. She's 22, only 22, already married 5 years. Her son, her four-year-old, has had a serious heart condition. She has fallen in love with his heart surgeon, a much older man. They're carrying on an affair. Her marriage falls apart. She moves back to Utah to move in with her folks. She's working a temp job at the old ZCMI department store, and with all of this swirling around, she steals a pot from the store. For whatever reason, she doesn't know what's going to happen with her future, with her son. She's not really sure about her faith or her plan to become a writer. All she knows is she wanted that pot. And the book is full of revelations like that, that bring on those contradictory feelings of excitement and shame. Today in the program, Judith Freeman is joining us to talk about the memoir, her candid and intimate story of growing up Mormon in Ogden. It's called The Latter Days. She's in town. She's going to be reading about it tonight. We'll give you some particulars about that. Judith Freeman is the author of four novels, a collection of short stories, a biography of the hard-boiled detective writer Raymond Chandler. And she's joining us here in the studio. And Judith Freeman, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Doug. It's so nice to be back with you.
Okay, so we're gonna sort of back up and talk a little bit more. But can I start with the stealing the pot story? What do you figure that was about?
Oh gosh, I think that pot must have represented some kind of future that I imagined that I would have. That my first marriage had just broken up, and I was back in my parents' house in this town where I'd started out after sort of making this extraordinary discovery that there were books out there in the world and that I wanted to write them. I think the pot, it also was a signature item. It was a Graham Kerr pot. He was one of the first.
The Galloping Gourmet.
Yeah. He had a television, a cooking program, you know, and this was, you know, very early on in that world. And I thought it had such cachet. It was not only the future, but it was a expensive pot, you know. It was a signature item. Yeah. And I stole it.
Yeah.
I thought that, you know, I just had to have it. I couldn't afford it.
This comes up a few times in the book. You steal the odd 20 here and there from a bank you're working at.
Yes, it was so embarrassing to have to reveal all of my sins and shortcomings. But it ended up being, you know, really facing up to a past and saying, yeah. I used to be a thief. I used to steal things because I couldn't afford them. And it was really only many years later that I realized that, you know, stealing is what keeps you feeling poor. Mm. It kind of traps you in that warp of bereftness. And you'll always you'll always feel poor as a thief. And when you stop stealing things, you realize that that kind of poverty, you can kind of shed it.
Yeah.
You know, sense of poverty.
So this, let's talk about how you begin thinking about writing a memoir. And there's this piece you write a few years ago. This was when Mitt Romney is running for president. Mm-hmm. You wrote a piece for the Los Angeles Review of Books called The Mormon Chronicles.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the first time you had really started to be personal in the way you were writing about Mormonism in this piece?
I think it's the first time that I dropped the scrim of fiction.
Yeah.
You know, I think if one were to go back and look at the Chinchilla Farm, right, you would see that there are certain stories that are repeated in my memoir. Mm-hmm. But now I had to go back and reclaim them from, you know, the world of novels and fiction.
Yeah.
And it wasn't easy to do because once you use a memory in a novel, it's almost as though you no longer own it in the same way.
Yeah.
It's been slightly corrupted.
Yeah.
So now is process of going back and retrieving some of those true stories that I had embedded in fiction. So I think it was the first time that I decided I'm going to try and write a more truthful account of my past.
Got a massive response when you wrote that Mormon Chronicles piece. Some kind of ugly, some kind of great, massive response. How do you explain that response? I think you'd mentioned at some point they'd never really gotten at that point so many comments on a piece.
Right. Los Angeles Review of Books had never gotten so many comments, but you could tell that it was kind of an orchestrated backlash because they misspelled the same words, many of them. You know, I can't remember exactly what the word was, but I am not a terribly sophisticated person when it comes to the internet, and I'd never experienced that kind of barrage of emails flowing in with just nasty subject lines. And I think it was coming because it was published on the eve of the Republican convention. It was coming from a number of different quarters, people who didn't see the humor in the piece that I'd written, Mitt Romney supporters who really didn't want polygamy discussed at that point, and perhaps some Mormons who felt that, you know, I had been disrespectful, and even members of my family, the Flakes of Snowflake, Arizona, would write to me and say, how could you? You know, our great-grandfather would be rolling over in his grave. Well, I don't know about that, but it was a conservative reaction to a piece that I think was quite nuanced.
See, but then you would think that you would kind of want to maybe back off and retreat because you had gotten such a vociferous response. But you said quite the contrary. It seems like you said that experience, in fact, made you want to write a memoir. That you and you even have said that writing that piece gave you a sense of a voice, helped you find a voice and a way of writing about your own background. What was it about that piece that made you?
It really upset me to get that reaction. I'm kind of thin-skinned. But on the other hand, when I think about my life as a writer, I've never backed away. I've never said, I'm not going to write this because I'm afraid.
Yeah.
And I think my father's harsh reaction to my first novel, which was incredibly painful, did one good thing for me, and that made me realize that I had crossed a bridge and I could never be intimidated again or be made afraid. That I would write what I wanted to write, hopefully with high consciousness, consideration, but I would never be intimidated again. I had sort of confronted the beast, and that was it. So I think even with all that blowback, I realized I'd found a tone and a way of writing about my past that I thought, for the very first time, I think I'm ready to write a memoir.
Mm. Yeah. Was it difficult? Did you ever feel ashamed of your Mormon past, that it was parochial and provincial and patriarchal and superstitious and, I mean, all of those things? Did you ever try to kind of rid yourself of that Mormon part of you in some way?
That's such a good central question. But I think that the central word is ashamed.
Yeah.
I think I was terribly conflicted in my life over my Mormon past because of the way they were viewed often as a peculiar people, a people that has been misunderstood, a secretive people, and yes, certainly a kind of a parochial people in some way. But I think in part that's their own fault for
sure.
Closing ranks at different points in their history. There probably was a little element of shame,
yeah.
But it was wedded probably also to the idea that I never went to college. So I wasn't one of those educated Mormons. I was kind of well, you get the point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if someone says to you, if they don't know you're a terrific writer and they learn that you're from Ogden or you're from Utah and they say, oh, are you Mormon?
Mm-hmm.
How do you respond these days?
I always say I was raised a Mormon.
Is that a hard question?
It is a bit of a hard question.
Yeah.
It's a real existential question.
You'd think it would be such a simple question, but it is so not, right?
I mean, would anyone ever ask Sherman Alexie, are you an Indian? You know,
yeah.
How do you, you know, and he's probably somewhat conflicted too, certainly about reservation life. But he would, you know, can you stop being a Blackfeet? Can you stop being Jewish? Can you stop being Mormon? Probably not, you know. You are how you were formed and created and molded and shaped. The problem is that Mormon comes mostly with the idea of religion.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
Most of us understand that it's also a very powerful culture and that it is, in fact, a kind of Western tribe. I mean, I have to credit Terry Tempest Williams for pointing that out to me because she was the first who really identified it as a tribe, and I think we are a tribe.
It's interesting, this question, as you are now sort of preparing, I'm imagining you starting to write this memoir. And you've got recollections, for sure. You've got your memory, but who can trust your memory? How much of those stories from your past do you figure you can trust? And I'm wondering, as you learned the reality of certain stories, some you had to rely on just your memory, how much was real and how much had you imagined? You know, if you've been able to figure that out, how much of your memory or your impression of that time do you think was even real?
I came to explore the whole idea of memory as much as I did my own life.
Totally, yeah.
Which is completely questioning how do we make memory? And can we trust memory? And are our memories true? And is my memory truer than your memory mm-hmm. if we were both there at a certain time? And I have to come, you know, to the point where I came to feel it's a big fiction. Memory is just an extraordinary construct. It's fiction. It's the way that we want to see ourselves and create a story about ourselves that makes us feel that we are or are becoming the kind of person we believe we are.
Mm.
And so it's a real fabrication, memory. But I think parts of it are very grounded in very true things. And
yeah.
The truest thing is the feeling that we had at a particular time when something happened and it made us feel. And that feeling is what endures.
Yeah.
And it's so powerful that we carry it. It's embedded in our brains. And around it over the years, we began to spin, you know, details that I think become, you know, not quite so true. They, they're there to serve us. And because of the plasticity of memory, we're constantly changing and mm-hmm. the story, adding to it, fixing it up a bit. So how much was true? How much did I look at and say, did this really happen the way that I'm writing about it? I think that there's an element that I would have to admit and say as a writer, I'm a storyteller,
yep.
and I was embellishing the story. I have to admit that. But I like to believe that I came close to telling a true story.
But you're honest about that in the book. There's the moment that comes later in the book when you're having a conversation with your now ex-husband, your first husband, in the story, and we'll get to this a little bit. And you're basically asking him, all right, let me sort of fact check some of these things in my memory. And one of the things is this recollection you have about your father. And there's a really interesting contradiction that comes up. And that surprised me that this would occur, that this would be so contradictory even later in your life. You had this image of your father as this dreamer, wanted to be a musician. He was a liberal in Utah at the time, which seemed kind of remarkable for the setting, certainly, generally conservative politically. And your dad was sort of outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you had sort of set aside the more unattractive parts, I suppose, of his personality, the fact that he could be really authoritarian and even kind of abusive at times.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't crazy abusive, but, you know, he could be physical. And
right.
he had set that stuff apart. Would you talk a little bit about that, what you make of that part that you had kind of set aside in your mind?
Yeah. When I went to talk to my ex-husband just a year ago, I was asking questions. And the biggest question at the center of it was, why did I get married at 17?
Yeah.
What was I thinking the day after I graduated from high school? And he gave me several pieces of information that were startling. And they had to do with my father. And the minute he said what he did, I knew it was true. Just as I thought, how can we possibly forget things that are so important? We remember funny little dumb stuff, but often we forget the most important things, the biggest things. Why do we bury them? I think one of the reasons I had buried some of this information about my father was because, quite simply, we're raised in a culture where we are trained from our earliest years that you must honor your father and mother so that your days may be long upon the land. Over and over we hear this. So it becomes really quite taboo
yeah.
to look at your parents and say, well, yes, they had these wonderful qualities, but they also had these qualities and they weren't so wonderful. And I felt hurt. And I felt injured. So I think that prohibition had reached the level of taboo. And all of us so long for the love of our parents and the approval that to stand up to them or to challenge them or to point out the less, you know, attractive aspects, it just wasn't something I was willing to risk.
So did it surprise you? Well, you said shocked. I think that's what you said. They were stunning anyway, the revelations that came about him. Were you disappointed about it? I mean, what did you when you recalled?
Well, without giving anything away,
yeah.
it did help answer that one central question.
Yeah.
Why did I get married when I was 17? Yeah. I wasn't a stupid girl. Why did I make that decision
yeah.
to get married? Well, you know, it really helped answer that question.
Right.
And yes, so it was stunning. It was kind of shocking. First of all, that the answer could come to me in that way, 50 years after I had married the man I did when I was 17. And secondly, that I could have forgotten that. Because it would have endowed me, had I remembered it, with a greater sense of self and dignity, I would have helped answer that question. It wouldn't be that I would lay it all off on someone else, mm-hmm. but I would be able to see that as a 17-year-old girl, there were a lot of forces at work on me
yeah.
that I couldn't control.
That revelation that he makes is remarkable, which we won't give away.
No, we shouldn't.
Judith Freeman is with us, the author of 7 books, including her latest. It's a memoir called The Latter Days. Tonight at 7 o'clock, she's going to be reading from and discussing and signing the book at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. We have details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Judith Freeman is joining us to talk about her new memoir. Freeman has made a name for herself, as you know, as a novelist. Her breakout book was The Chinchilla Farm. You may remember Red Water, a novel built around the Mountain Meadows Massacre. But now she's removed that scrim of fiction, as she explained earlier on the program, and is really candid and frank about her life growing up in Ogden as a Mormon. The book is called The Latter Day. She's in town talking about it, reading from it. We'll give you some more particulars. She's joining us here in the studio. I love the stories of the turquoise notebook. Your junior year in high school, in your Mormon seminary class, you're given this notebook. And you talk about how you sort of avoided looking at it for years. But then... And I imagine, was it when you were writing this book that you started to open it up, or had you just looked at it over
yes.
time?
Yes. Yeah. No, my parents had passed away in the 90s, and it came back to me. And the moment I saw it, this workbook just stuffed, you know, with handouts and, responses and essays in that class, I just thought, I don't want to look at that. But every once in a while, I'd sort of take a peek.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, it's like opening it up and then saying, oh, no, I'm not ready to think about that.
But what were you worried about? Because you write about that you said it contained real proof of your past and what it might reveal. What was it? Were you worried that if you saw that you might see in there actual belief? You seemed to be all in as a Mormon, even though you didn't really think of yourself that way later in life?
I think that I realized I would see evidence of real confusion.
Sure.
But I also think, my early childhood was pretty happy.
Yeah.
It was quite wonderful, this big family of 8 kids and really good parents. But the moment that I hit puberty... The moment a girl starts to inhabit her body and acquire sexuality, big problems. Big problems for me, especially if you were a little bit drawn to the wild side.
Yeah.
I mean, I never thought of myself as a real wild girl, but I was kind of a wild Mormon girl.
Yeah.
And, right. I think I also had to figure out how to navigate that life and that world and that family and those expectations and the religion and the culture. Because part of me was very attracted to just doing bad things, smoking and drinking and choosing non-Mormon friends. But another part of me knew that in order to pass, to get by, to get along, that I'd have to find a way to go along.
Yeah.
And I knew in that turquoise notebook I would find that girl who was getting along and going along.
You couldn't bear it.
Well, I just thought, it's so, it's like dissembling. It's like a split personality. It's like, does anyone want to look at that version of themselves that is kind of toadying and doing what you need to do to please the powers that be? Whereas you feel yourself developing into a very different person.
Yeah.
So I was afraid of what I would find because I thought I would find evidence of the confusion that I'd felt at that time and the deep unhappiness.
You write this, because you write about these You really were kind of a wild girl for a Mormon. And yeah, you'd go to the, you'd find half-burned cigarettes in the stadium parking lot, I guess at Weber State, right?
Right. Doesn't that sound disgusting to pick up, you know, half-smoked cigarettes?
But then you and a friend would raid her father's liquor cabinet, and you were, of course, experimenting sexually all these times. But you write about, you said, you write this, chafing against the religion and all its strictures. On one hand, yet on the other hand, feeling the need to often pretend otherwise. And you said you were developing this schism. I guess that's what you're talking about. It was that sense of kind of that almost schizophrenic sense of who you were. On one hand, the wild child. On the other hand, the one who maybe feels like you should go along and get along. Yeah?
Right. Right. And I think that kind of upbringing can take a long time to reconcile. And it's one of the problems growing up in a kind of strict religious culture. And I don't want to represent all Mormon culture like that, because I don't want to represent my experience as having any kind of universal application. There were liberal Mormon families. There were families that were able to see the complexity, the nuance. Everything wasn't black and white. But I think the difficulty of growing up in a more rigid, patriarchal, religious culture is that you are, for lack of a better word, indoctrinated.
Yeah.
And then beneath that is another self emerging that's really trying to figure out, who am I? What do I want? What do I like? Who do I like? Why do I like them? Why do I not want to do this? And there was much about the religion that didn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
I didn't understand why I couldn't ride my horse on Sunday. I just didn't get that.
Because that to you was a kind of worship. I mean, the joy that you had in nature riding that horse in the Wasatch Mountains was
exactly
amazing.
I couldn't see why reading the funny papers and eating a huge meal was a more preferable way to spend the Sabbath than being out in nature in wilderness on a beautiful animal and, you know, being completely aware of the magic in the world.
There's this story you tell in the book about this incident at Bear Lake, and you're almost injured by this outboard motor. It came close to your head. It could have been dreadful. And as a young woman, you'd written about, you said in this little essay, you, and I guess, was this in the turquoise notebook that you found? Was this particular story?
Yes, it was an essay I'd written, you know, I think the assignment was describe a faith-promoting incident or something like that.
And so
that.
Looking back, you say that you were, the way you had written the essay was that you had said this little prayer and God protected you. But then looking back on it, you say in the memoir that you were pretty sure you didn't utter a prayer. So what was that?
I think when I was underwater and there was a speedboat buzzing above my head and I was trying to find the dock, when you are in an emergency situation like that, to imagine that a 13 or 14-year-old girl will suddenly stop and offer up a prayer is so unrealistic. But in that seminary class, to describe a faith-promoting incident for the assignment, I just reconfigured it. You know, already I was a little fiction writer.
I was going to say, that's exactly right.
Who knew? But I knew what was expected of me. And I knew the way to get a good grade on this assignment was to just add another element to that moment that I offered up a prayer and God helped bring me to the surface and avoid those terrible blades. But I think that this is really one of the more problematic aspects of, you know, not just that assignment in this culture, but in general, the way we try and train children.
Faith promoting.
To perform in ways we want them to perform and to tell us stories that we want to hear, as opposed to letting them be more authentic in their responses.
Can I ask you the story that I found intriguing about when you get your patriarchal blessing, and maybe we could explain what that is for the uninitiated. It's this big, important, significant blessing that you get from a so-called Mormon patriarch. And the way you write about it is so fascinating. It seems like there are these two things going on when you're receiving this blessing. And then when it's over, you open your eyes and you talk about how the light floods in. And that kind of breaks the spell. And then there you have this strange feeling. Would you talk about this experience? Because I think I found it really interesting.
Well, there's a lot of magic in Mormonism. And I think there was even more in the early church. And I think it was was a kind of wonderful aspect to our religion, that if you believe and if you, you know, believe that someone can heal you with a laying on of hands, and we now know there's a great deal of power in rituals like that. So it comes out of something kind of substantive, but when you undergo that as a child, it's as though you are being taken into a realm of magic. And elders are leading you there, and things are happening to you that are quite remarkable. And the patriarchal blessing, everyone receives one of those, and it's supposed to be, in a way, a little guide to your life, what you might expect is in store for you. In reality, I think many of the same things are often said to many people. And yet it's a quite holy feeling to receive a blessing and to say, you know, you will have children and you will be successful in your field, and young women will come to you with their troubles, and you will marry someone. But then at the end, you know, you will be resurrected as a queen and a princess on high. Well, when you're told that and you're a teenager, you think, that just sounds remarkable. Until you realize all of this is only going to happen after you're dead. And then you think, well, it really wasn't. It was a magical moment for me. But it was also one of those things that I feel... I felt almost a little tender about revealing because it was so private.
Was it a moment of... there was the magic there, but also was there somewhere in the back... Because you say that the patriarch looks down at you and pats your cheek. And you say that and with that gesture, the feeling in the room changed and everything sort of returned to the way it had been before. So there were two things going on, if I'm understanding the story right. There was the magic part, and then there's the breaking of the spell part.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there was always that, and I think there is always that in religion.
Right.
There's the moment when you're transported and you're transcended into some kind of high spiritual state, however that comes about.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, you're back in a spare bedroom, you know, with two old people, the wife who has the recorder, and the patriarch, who's a very, very old man, and the lawnmower buzzing outside on a hot summer day. So it's kind of an idea that we encourage the idea of parallel worlds.
When we get back from a break, let's talk about you playing Anne Frank in high school, shall we?
Okay.
I thought this was a great moment also. Judith Freeman is with us. Her new memoir is called The Latter Days. At 7 o'clock tonight, she's going to be reading the book at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. We have details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Judith Freeman. We're talking about her latest book. It's a memoir called The Latter Days. She's going to be reading from it tonight at the King's English Bookshop. We'll give you a few more details about that a little bit later. 1964, you're a senior in high school, and you're desperate to get this part of Anne Frank in the school play. And I love this part because you write about how on some level you were changed by this experience. And not only that, profoundly changed. And this is how you put it in the book. You said you had, with that experience, inhabited a work of literature written by a girl my age and discovered language. Because you weren't much of a reader. You weren't really into literature, not till later in your life. That comes later, which you explain in the book. But here's your first encounter, real encounter in some ways, with literature. Is that right?
It really is. I didn't read many books growing up. I wasn't a very good student. I much preferred the outdoors, but I really wanted to play Anne Frank in our high school production. And I don't think at the time I really understood what a profound experience it would be to inhabit such an extraordinary work as that play. It was first produced in 1956, so it had only been 8 years since the world had really begun to realize what had happened to the Frank family and the people who had hidden in that attic in Amsterdam in an attempt to survive an enormous evil. I mean, an evil almost greater than anything we could have imagined. The power of that story and the way I personalized it, because Anne was a rebel. She had a much nicer, older sister that her mother really preferred. The people in the attic got really tired of Anne's shenanigans and her, you know, her kind of lippiness. And she also had this longing, you know, for Peter, for she had strong romantic sexual feelings that were beginning to arise in her. But she was also so honest in that she left this diary for the world later, fortunately, to discover. It tapped into so many feelings that I was experiencing at that particular time, not to draw any parallel whatsoever. But Anne Frank's diary is really a very personal story of a girl that was the same age as I was. And memorizing those words was a very powerful experience. Not being a real reader, it was as though I had discovered the power of language.
There's this story then that comes a few years later. You get married at 17. Big plans to go off into the Peace Corps with your husband. You have this great adventure that you have in mind, and then you get pregnant.
Right.
And you lay this out in the book. And your son, and we'll get to this a bit in a moment, has this congenital heart defect. But you and your husband moved to St. Paul. And you go to this college, and this is where you discover literature really for the first time. And you go to this class. Is it McAllister?
Right. Right.
And there's this terrific guy, Roger Blakely. Who's right. Your professor? And you read Thomas Hardy. You read Tess of D'Oberville, the A Pure Woman Faithfully Presented. You read this book.
Right.
And it's interesting when you're talking about Anne Frank, here's another story that you really relate with. Tess in this story has the same number of siblings that you did. She's also a child who loves nature like you did. Has a weak mother, a domineering dreamer of a father like you did. Gives birth to a baby who's not well. Would you talk about the importance of this particular story? Because I found this really interesting, too. Here you are again, relating to this literary character.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that, Doug, until you pointed out that there is that incredible attraction and personalizing of my first experiences of literature. So I must have had to enter the idea of literature and great books and writing by finding something I could identify with, by finding a way to say, oh, this is a storyteller who's just told a story, but I feel such a strong pull to that story. I see myself in that girl, in Anne Frank or in Tessa of the D'Oberville. So I don't know. I really hadn't thought of that. But Tess in particular is shamed. She is shamed for being comely, yeah. for attracting the male gaze. Yeah. She's basically coming from a rural and sophisticated place, and she's taken advantage of badly. She makes a bad choice.
Yeah.
I could certainly see myself in all of that.
Yeah.
And she ends up a really tragic figure. And I think at that moment when I discovered literature in that class at McAllister College, I was beginning to feel myself that my life was set on a course and I was powerless to alter it. I had a very sick child. I wasn't happy in my marriage. I couldn't see my future. I couldn't see what was going to happen to me. And I think that's Hardy's test for much of that book. She's living in a very fragile state.
She's also a non-believer. She's a pagan. She doesn't
yes.
believe, as you say, in religious dogma. She believes in kindness.
She believes in loving kindness.
Yeah.
She's a child of nature,
yeah.
and I was always a child of nature. So that was another strong point of identification. She couldn't buy it either.
At what point did you finally admit to yourself that you didn't believe in the Mormon story anymore? Can you remember? Can you trace it back?
I really wonder. It's such a fuzzy kind of question in a way, because it has so many layers to it. And one layer is simply that I was seeking freedom. I was seeking freedom from men who told me what to do, men who shamed me, a kind of patriarchy that I felt was overwhelming and crushing at times. I wanted out. Did I want out from the religion because of those things? Just normal teenage rebelliousness? Or did I really have the capacity at that point to wrestle with questions of faith
yeah.
and belief, to challenge the idea of indoctrination? Was I just seeking self more than I was rejecting this? I think it's all of those things. But I think there were some things, as I've mentioned, that never did make sense to me, and that I never did have that thing that everyone talks about, and which I respect very much when people do acquire it. And that is a testimony and a commitment to the church. I never had that.
Ever?
No. Not even, I think, as a child. But as I began to emerge, I found reasons to want to push back against family, against culture, against religion. And I don't know, is that just my nature?
Yeah.
I think we are all born with such strong natures and inclinations. And I think mine was to strike out. I was, in a way, hungry for the world, for other experiences, for simply maybe the other.
Yeah.
What's different than me?
You go to this Unitarian church with a mm-hmm. friend. And this experience seems to really have started to broaden your approach. It gave you a different way of thinking of, I mean, you grew up with this idea that there was one true church.
Mm-hmm.
And you found this kind of ecumenical approach that I think was meaningful to you, it seems. And I wondered now, I'm going to guess that most of your siblings are probably still pretty straightforwardly Mormon. Yes?
Yes.
And that's kind of a personal question, so you answered. Sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, that's fine. They would be happy for me to say that.
Yeah, okay, good. And your relationship with them, even now, is it still defined on the idea that you are now an outsider?
Mm-hmm.
Because this, does it have to be? Why does it have to be that you couldn't just get along with your siblings and have a different perception of this big, huge thing?
Well, I think there are many people within the church who can do that.
Yeah.
They can be outsiders and their siblings can be insiders. And there's a great flowing of love and good feeling and goodwill. I also think that sometimes it creates real divisions, and they're very painful. And those divisions were created in my family at a particular moment. But I think of Czesław Miłosz, the poet, who once said, when a writer is born into a family, that family is finished. And when I heard that quote, I laughed, and then I kind of took a deep breath, because I think writers are mostly most effective when they step outside. They often don't make that step by themselves. They just end up there. It's just as though you are shifted to the periphery. That's just what happens. It's what happened with me. It doesn't happen with every family.
Right.
But if you were born within a strong religious culture that sees the world in fairly strict or black and white terms and has a rather proscribed set of beliefs, and you want to be a novelist in which it's the ambiguities in the world and the complexities, the gray areas that we're always going to be investigating. It just,
so it's literature that screwed you up.
Yeah, it is. It certainly wasn't my family. I mean, it maybe it's the calling. Maybe it's part and parcel of being a writer. Or maybe it's just me. I don't know.
What do you keep from Mormonism, if anything at all?
I think that all of my siblings, my brother Jerry particularly, who was gay and who died of AIDS in 1994, he was the kindest man. And we were all trained to be so helpful to elderly people, to be kind and helpful, to be generous, to think of other people. I certainly retain that happily.
But you seem content to be now an outlier. Was that a difficult thing?
There are times when I have rather wistful feelings about it.
Yeah.
I think particularly in when I return to Utah. And I see the landscape that formed me, and I have a great affection for the landscape and for the places and for the memories. It would be nice to be a part again, to belong. Everyone wants to belong. Everyone wants community. I have a different kind of community now. But I think that one thing that writing this book has done, it's brought me into a more gentle relationship with my past, with who I am, with where I came from, and it very rarely do I feel like something is missing in my life.
So it's helped you let go. I mean, I heard you tell the story on an interview not so long ago where you mentioned that there might have been a time in the past when coming to Utah would have kind of stressed you out, like, I got to stop and see the Sibs. I guess they've mostly congregated in southern Utah these
That's
days,
right.
I guess. And so you felt this kind of, I got it. But it seems like maybe this experience writing this book has let you realize that, not that you don't want to see your family, but there's not the same kind of obligation.
What I think it has made it clear is, and I know it's a word that's used a lot right now, but what's important is to be authentic. If you want to visit your siblings, please visit them. It's very important.
Yep.
If you only have an hour and you're on your way to another place and you think it's going to be awkward or difficult, don't feel guilty. Don't worry about it. They won't. You shouldn't. You should. The authentic impulses are really something to be really valued. And I think it brings us into truer relationships, stronger relationships, relationships that have a better future.
Your father when you wrote The Chinchilla Farm, even though you had sort of veiled it in that scrim of fiction, he read through it. He knew that you were writing about your family in some ways, your life, and he was angry about it. And not only that, he did this. He made this very cutting comment. Not only did he say you revealed too much, you're being disrespectful to the faith, you should have kept some stuff private. He said this. He said, and the book isn't even very good. There's nothing there. It's boring.
Right. And it was at the moment at which I realized that when my father was upset, he had to hurt someone. And I don't think that's such an unusual impulse. I've seen it myself. You get angry and you strike out. You have to hurt someone. And he was really angry about my book. It wasn't until later that I understood perhaps what had upset him the most. It wasn't the stories about the religion. It wasn't the stories about my family. It wasn't the way I'd portrayed my past, except that I had made us look poor.
Yeah.
And before my mother died, she said, you have to understand, that's what really upset your father about your book. You made us look poor. And he always thought he'd been such a good provider, so you hurt his pride. I don't think as writers we can ever anticipate what it is that might upset someone. Not the thing we thought if we write about someone else.
No, because there's such personal filter that you're reading these things.
Exactly.
That's what's so personal about literature, I guess.
Yeah,
and reading.
Exactly. So, that was a very painful moment. And it was very cruel. The book wasn't boring. Something was there.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't
turned
nothing.
Turned out pretty well, yeah.
You know? And some families would have said, wow, we have a writer in our family, aren't we? You know, aren't we lucky? And some families would say, oh, God, what is she going to write next? You know, and have a kind of anxiety. I think he had that anxiety that I wasn't to be trusted. And yet I've always felt in my work that I've tried to be generous, fair, open, that if I'm going to be critical, I'll be as critical of myself as anyone else.
Judith Freeman, her book is The Latter Days, a memoir. She's reading from it tonight at 7 o'clock at the King's English Bookshop. You can get details about it on our website, radiowest.org. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.